All right.
Recording.
All right. Take cinco. Cue the music.
Cue the music.
One from the vaults.
There we go. Where was it? There it is.
Hello and welcome to the Higher Things Simulcast, a highly organized, daringly Lutheran train wreck of a podcast. I am Sandra Ostapowicz, and I'm here with Pastor Donovan Riley.
Maybe.
Maybe.
I thought this was better.
I thought it was better, too.
Here with Pastor Donovan Riley.
Rejuvenated, renewed, and on a 7-second delay for your own safety.
And Pastor Christopher Gillespie picking our music and producing the show.
Yeah, I don't have anything new to say this time through. Sorry.
It's not We've been having some technical issues this time around. Getting back into the swing of things. But we're figuring it out.
We're figuring it out as
we go. We're figuring it out. Play along with us.
Or faking it anyway.
Yeah. Until we make it.
Don't let them in on the secret.
That's right.
We're supposed to know what we're doing. Speaking of, what are we doing?
I don't know. I don't know anymore. What are we doing? Tonight, I thought we'd talk about what has happened in the Christian church just really in even the last 10 or 20 years. The whole, at least in my area, my community, the whole dynamic of who's coming into the church on Sunday mornings and who engages me as a pastor is like the whole face of the community has changed in the last 10 or 20 years. And as one pastor I was talking with last week had made the comment, up until a couple years ago, you didn't even see somebody with tattoos in church on Sunday. It was very rare you saw someone with tattoos in church in his church on Sundays. And now he's got 10 or 12 people in church that are tattooed Christians in their 30s and 40s. And we were talking about kind of subcultures within the church or subcultures just in general in the community and engaging them in the community. And then when they do come to church, addressing and engaging them, their questions, where they're coming from. And what that means for ministry, what that means for the church, that we have all these different groupings and culture and society like to break everything down into categories and, you know, kind of neatly define everything.
Put everyone in their pigeonholes.
Right. So to market to them, essentially. And,
right.
And so, you need Pepsi for people with tattoos, and then you need Pepsi for people that ride motorcycles, and then you break down what kind of motorcycles they ride and where they ride their motorcycles, off-road or on-road, and you just kind of brand market to those people. And that, but it's so fragmented. It's become so tribal, to quote one sociologist, that it's almost impossible to come up with just one single kind of scheme or kind of cookie cutter, program that says, here, this is the definitive guide to reaching those who are, in your community who don't belong to your church or how do you talk to people who come into your church? And I was even talking, today, actually, I was talking with a celibate gay man in the LCMS about his experience of celibacy the last 5 years and how even that influences, you know, his conversations in church, but also just in the community at large, and how the church chooses to engage or not engage that community. And so what do we do with all of that in the present tense? You know, not just obviously from the pastoral side of things, but from the people, you know, in the congregation, what do we do with the changing it's so fluid. That's the thing, right? Is it's not
right.
This is a fad, and then in 5 or 6 years it becomes commodified, and then we're on to the next thing. You know,
it's changing every few months.
But yeah, you know, if you look at social media, I was just looking at the metrics for the different social media platforms this morning, and the movement of young people from different social media platforms, and
go where the adults aren't.
Right, exactly. That's so church is definitely out of the question. If that's your measuring stick is like not go where there's adults, then church is definitely not the place to go. But the church, as you know too, I mean, the church, every generation the church spends just almost scandalous amounts of money to figure out how to market to the next generation of young people. And We've talked about that on this program. We're Gen X, and they spent a lot of money to figure out how to get Gen Xers to come to church. And then by the time they got all their research back, it was the Gen Xers had grown up and either left the church or moved, you know, or just become entrenched. But then it was millennials and
whatever came after the millennials,
whatever comes after the millennials, yeah. You know, is it's so fluid. And it's easy, I think, to say or to be kind of smug and say, well, it's just the word and the sacrament. That's all you need. As long as you have the gospel and the sacraments, or as long as you have the historic liturgy, or as long as you have praise bands and music, or as long as you have X, Y, and Z, then that's the thing. That's the key, as though it's some sort of like magic, you know, incantation. If we just say it enough times, it'll come true.
Well, I to an extent that it is true. I mean, that's what the church is supposed to be about, is having the gospel preached in its purity and the administration of the sacraments. That's right. What the church does. And anything else is kind of just gravy and frosting on the cake. Maybe not gravy and frosting, but, you know, just the extra.
That's fattening.
Right? Disgusting.
That was such a Midwestern analogy. Gravy and
well, you know, but it, one without the other. You know, that's just a nice extra that the church can do to make itself more comfortable, more accommodating to different groups of people. You know, kind of like, you know, when sound systems were put into churches, you know, they didn't always have them, and you know, microphones and how that was going to be, you know, such a controversial thing, and screens in some churches, or, you know, making bathrooms accessible, or, you know, putting a changing table in the men's room, or, you know, different things like that churches do to be more welcoming and accommodating to people. That's a little different from the church doing things to market itself to certain subgroups of the culture and the surrounding community. And when churches do that, then you can start getting into a dangerous ground, and that takes over what the church is doing, and you fit in the word and sacrament around your other stylistic changes that you're doing.
Yeah. Let's go back to what you referenced, because you referenced it, but it wasn't actually a direct reference, is that it is enough for the unity of the church that the gospel is preached in the sacrament. For the unity of the church, it's enough. Right, seven. That Augsburg Confession 7 for you who are playing the home game, that it's enough for the unity of the church that these two things are occurring. That's not, though, what the church is. We can say that is essentially what the church is, the preaching the gospel and the mystery of the sacrament. You can't have a church. You can't have the big C Catholic church without the gospel and the sacraments. And yet, since you reference it, and we're just going where we're going, that can be used in so many different ways. I've seen it used, and I've heard it used in so many different ways to justify just about every church practice imaginable, under the umbrella of, well, we still preach the gospel and minister the sacraments, and therefore, or but, you know, there's always that there's always a qualification. And, and if you use a historic liturgy, you use it as an excuse to vilify those who don't use historic liturgy. If you don't use historic liturgy, you use it to vilify those who do. If you don't wear vestments, you use it, you know, it's you add all these qualifications to the preaching the gospel and the sacraments to say, well,
it's not enough.
It's not enough because you're not doing what I like. And we hear this all the time in the church to say, you know, that one group of pastors who use the historic liturgy, I use the historic liturgy, and work out of the hymnal, will say of those who don't, well, we're not saying you're not Lutheran. We're just saying you're not confessional Lutherans.
Right. We've got these subgroups. You're not really confessional Lutherans, because Lutheranism by itself, it is confessional. It's a confession of faith. But then we subgroup it to confessional Lutherans and, you know, liberal Lutherans who the rest of the world looks at and says, y'all are really conservative liberals.
Right, exactly.
I don't know how you define a liberal, but
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what poker game you go to on Friday night, but
within the LCMS and Lutheranism, that is still very conservative. But in comparison to the more conservative traditional ends, it's very, very liberal, and it's all in addition to the whole unity of the church in the word and sacrament. And And yes, the argument can be made that this is these things are important because it is how we deliver word and sacrament, and the means do matter. But then that can also just overtake everything else.
Well, then when do the instruments themselves become the gospel?
Or replace the gospel, yeah.
Or just replace them altogether. They say, right. Well, it's not enough that you preach the gospel because you can't preach the gospel unless you do it in this context or through these means.
Exactly. It won't work.
Right.
If you don't, you know, hold your hands just mm-hmm. so or wear the right clothes,
right.
The gospel doesn't work. But
right.
Are we really sure we want to say that?
We do. Let's not play house. I mean, we do. We say that all the time. I do that all the time, too. I mean, we just do it. It's a natural byproduct of sin, of original sin, is just to say, if you know, anything that's different than what I prefer or the yes or no of my personal taste buds is then therefore not right, not just, it's just not godly because I don't do that.
We're always about dividing between us and them.
Right.
And there's always going to be something to divide us from
right.
them.
Right.
But, you know, back to, you know, the AC7, the Augsburg Confession, Article 7,
yeah.
We're about unity. And so we should actually be looking for things to pull us together
right.
rather than emphasizing the things that divide us.
Are you suggesting that the fruit of faith may be love? that love may be that unifying factor?
Well, then we're going to have to talk about what love is.
Yes, won't we? The faithful loving kindness of God, the pursuit of those who are our enemy. That while
right.
we were still enemies, Christ died for us while we were still sinners.
And there's the whole idea of tough love and enforcing boundaries, and that's also love, and not just accepting and tolerating anything and everything that someone does.
Hmm.
Which is how the world would define love.
Yeah. But that becomes manipulative
it
and
can.
Controlling. It is.
It can.
It does very quickly. We beat each other over the head with our doctrine. And use the freedom of the gospel as an excuse not only to sin, but also as an excuse to reject the gospel.
Yeah.
And therefore reject loving each other and living in that unity.
That's the kind of sinners we are. We can turn even the gospel into something self-serving.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But it goes back to the original point, too, is that not only are we dealing with these kind of quote-unquote subcultures that are in our community, but we've already created subcultures in our church.
Oh, of course.
And perhaps that is also a stumbling block to our own engagement of people who are other than us. Or when someone walks into the church on Sunday and we just say, I don't know how to talk to this person because everything about them outwardly and the way that they speak, I don't know how to talk to this. I don't know how to engage this person. They don't, you know, he or she doesn't talk like me. They don't dress like me. And I'm not quite sure why they're at this church.
Yeah, I mean, that happens. That happens, you know, with generational issues. It happens with, you know, racial and cultural mm-hmm. and economic class issues.
Yeah.
All the things that divide us makes me think of, you know, Galatians 3:28, the big verse about how there's no Jew or Greek or slave or free,
yeah.
male or female. We're all one in Christ. So we're back to unity again.
Yeah, there it is.
I know, yeah. I know. And those things shouldn't matter to our oneness in Christ. But, you know, that's the other side. Then they do because we're sinners. And we're always looking for those things that divide us and separate us from one another. And those things are things that our old Adam grabs onto and says, mm-hmm. They're not like me. I don't mm-hmm. think I like that. That makes me uncomfortable. And I'm just going to, you know, go back into my shell and hide
right.
until I think it's safe again.
So then outside of Christ, there can be no true unity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's how we are unified, is in Christ.
So then by creating these subdivisions within our own churches, by you know, kind of walking away, you know, confusing Lutheran theology or Reformation Lutheran theology with Lutheranism, which is the history of the undoing of the doctrine of justification by faith alone through Christ alone, that outside of Christ, we end up creating these categories and these subdivisions within and without. So what is it that can overcome those subdivisions and those categorical divisions that we use to justify and make ourselves righteous in our own, you know, view?
Right, because, you know, we're the ones who are right and the other people are wrong. That's inevitably
always.
How it goes.
Right.
Well, I think a big part of it is, you know, being bold enough to acknowledge the reality that, you know, hey, I'm uncomfortable. I don't know this person. They're not familiar with to me. But, you know, they're here. They're here to receive the same things that I'm receiving. So I can, you know, step out of my comfort zone and try and be welcoming to them and, you know, talk to them, be friendly, be polite, find out more about them as people, because we may actually have more in common than I may think on the surface. And I'm not going to find that out until I talk to them.
Right.
And exactly. So, I mean, just even having a conversation like normal people,
right,
over coffee, before you go into church, after church, whatever, that can go a long ways to not only making your church in general more welcoming to people, but also to making people want to come and come back. Because if they're not welcome, if they're treated like they're weirdos, then they're not going to come back. I mean, would you?
No. That's why I'm a pastor, though. God won't let me escape.
You're stuck.
He's trapped me by virtue of my office as a called and ordained servant of Christ. Which is a good point, though, is then how do we judge another person's faith? If we can't judge them based on the way they look, or maybe we should. Maybe we should, you know, judge me by the way I look. I've been told plenty of times, just in the last couple of months, I've been told plenty of times, I'm not a Christian because I have tattoos.
No, I thought it was just because you're funny looking.
No, that'd be a whole nother. That's a whole subset of critiques. It's not the years, it's the miles. I literally have attacked a parking lot with my face at one point in time. I do not recommend doing that ever. But you will lose 100% of the time. But no, how do we? Because this is really, you know, going back to what you brought up, is that if it is enough. Satis est in the Latin, if it is enough for the true unity of the church, that the gospel is preached in its purity and the sacraments are rightly administered, rightly, correctly administered, according to the institution of Christ himself, then what are we doing when we judge another person's faith, regardless of whether they're homeless looking or that they are well-dressed, whether they look poor, whether they look wealthy, whether they are well-spoken or whether they have a potty mouth, whether they look like us or don't look anything like us. You know, that's how we tend to judge people and then judge their faith based on their outward appearance or the way they speak. If it's enough that the gospel is preached in its purity and the sacraments correctly administered, then how do we judge a person's faith in that situation?
I'm not sure that that's entirely our place to be judging their faith. We can judge their confession.
Sure.
And confession is not...
I like that.
Not only the words that you say, but also the practices that you do, that you come to the table, the Lord's table, and you receive the Lord's Supper. That's a confession of your faith, that you are there to receive the gifts, or that you're there because you have questions and you want to understand. That's another confession of faith. That's not a bad thing.
Right.
I think it's a big temptation for us to look at people and judge whether they're Christian or not based on what we see. And the problem there is, yes, sometimes you can see when people are living in accordance with their outward confession, you know, if they're being hypocrites or not. That is sometimes visible. A lot of times it's not.
I was going to say, as a pastor, most of the time it's not.
Right. And a lot of times it's not invisible when they are living out their faith. Right. Because we only see a very, very, very small snippet of any person's life. And so it's not fair of us to judge someone, whether they're Christian or not, based on that. Not to mention that, you know, we're in no place. That's God's job. And they're going to be, who wants to judge us on that, too?
Well, here's a bigger question then, because this goes back to what you're saying about Galatians, is that when we are focused on Christ, obviously the gospel and the sacraments point to Christ and him alone, justification through him alone, by grace through faith. If we're focused on Christ, then how do I have time to look at my neighbor and judge whether he has faith or not, whether he's a hypocrite or not?
Yeah. I mean, because if you're focused on Christ and your eyes are on Christ, then why are you looking at your neighbor? You shouldn't even be looking at yourself.
Well, exactly. That's the point, is like you pointed out, is that to be hearers of the word and doers of the word, to be made into doers, not just hearers of the word, to have lungs that are full of air, as one of my favorite professors said, you know, the analogy that faith and works are like lungs full of oxygen. You know, faith is the oxygen, the lungs are the works. You can't separate the two because they're both gifts of God. And so not just the hearing of the gospel, but the coming forward and to receive the gifts, the doing of the gospel, is one and the same. And it's like trying to divide belief and baptism, like the old Adam likes to do. The old Adam likes to say, well, I believe, why do I have to be baptized? Even though it's a conjunction, it's believe and be baptized.
Right.
Because the new man in Christ through faith says, not only do I believe, but what else do you have? Like, what other gifts do I get to open? Well, I have baptism. And you're like, okay, give it to me.
More.
And then more. Yes, exactly. And to be grounded in that reality, baptismal reality, sacramental reality, the reality of the gospel, which frees us from our bondage to sin and the condemnation of the law. In Christ, then, we have what, you know, this unity, this oneness, however you want to say this, this assembly of the saints, these saintly sinners. And yet, as soon as I take my focus off of Christ and the gifts, his body and blood, I start looking at myself and judging myself in relation to Christ and the gifts, and I start judging my neighbor in relation to me and in relation to God. And all of a sudden, I'm not talking about Jesus anymore. I'm talking about God in a very generalized, abstract sort of way. And then I start judging our unity or our togetherness based not on Christ crucified for the sins of the whole world, or what Paul in 1 Corinthians 1, that God made him to become sin who knew no sin, that I might become the righteousness of God. We might become the righteousness of God. Rather than looking at my sin on the cross, I look at myself and go, well, I still have sin in myself.
Well, of course you do.
And therefore...
You're not dead yet.
Right. And yet there I am being put to death.
Right.
And because I don't want to die, I don't. I don't want to die. I have too much to live for. I have a wife and children. I have stuff I still want to do. I look at my neighbor and I say, okay, how can I sacrifice my neighbor in my place? Like, how can my neighbor die for me rather than me having to do this?
You mean like throw him under the bus?
Yeah, like throw him under the bus and say, well, I know that I'm a sinner. You know, this is always my favorite qualification. I know that I'm a sinner, but...
but that guy is way worse.
Right. Like, I may be like a 51% sinner, but that dude is like 78%. And it's like the old joke about the bear, you know, that two guys are walking in the woods. And I've said this before, two guys are walking in the woods. The bear runs at him. And the one guy stops to tie his shoes. And the other guy says, you can't outrun a bear. And he said, I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you. Is that
right?
When we take our eyes off Christ, we're just trying to outrun God's judgment, even though all of God's judgment has already been put on Jesus.
It's already on Christ.
Already on Christ. And so through faith in Christ, that judgment is no longer applicable. It doesn't. It's historically, like, it's finished. It's completed. And therefore, we can focus on the preaching of the gospel and the administration of the sacraments.
All right. So that's the end of the first part of this week's podcast. Stay tuned later this week for the second half.